the last, this first 6 weeks in here?
House Committee on Revenue for March 20th, 2017 will come to order. Colleagues, today we have two public hearings, one on House Bill 2088 involving defining areas for the purpose of ad valorem property tax statutes, and a bill involving volumetric mixers, 2022. So if we're ready, we will open the public hearing on the first bill, House Bill 2088. Kyle, is that yours? Okay. Kyle will introduce it, and then we'll see what we have for testimony.
This place is a petri dish.
Thank you. Oh, good.
Okay. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2088, it has to do with the CPR computation and in a few instances where,
I'm sorry, the what?
The CPR, I'm sorry, the changed property ratio.
Thank you.
And how...
Please, go ahead.
I'll try to...
Yeah, please don't use acronyms.
Just hit math.
This is an item of new impression for many of our committee members.
Okay.
Thank you.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I will back up. House Bill 2088. In the staff measure summary, there's some information in the background, and I'll start from there because that probably sets up the changes then that are made in House Bill 2088. But this is from Article 11, Section 11.1 of the Oregon Constitution, and you can see there's a listing up there of A through F that discusses when property go through changes, and in most cases you think of it as new property coming on the roll, so a home that's new built, a piece of commercial property or something that's newly built or additions to property, and then some of the other changes as well. But the way that the value comes on the roll, and this has to do with the Measure 50 distinction between real market value and assessed value. So when new property comes on the roll, you initially set the real market value at its real market value, but then you need to determine its assessed value based upon the countywide average of real market value and maximum assessed value, which is generally going to be assessed value, but it's slightly different. But for just a conceptual understanding, it will equal assessed value. So you come on at a ratio. So if the ratio is, say, 75% of real market value for all like property, like class property, then the new property would come on at 75% of its real market value. And that's the average for all like property. So a new house comes on at the average real market value, assessed value of all property within that county. And the idea is you give it the same assessed value average break from the real market value that's the average of the countywide, if that makes sense. So those are the general, that's the general types of property that'd be affected by this. What the change would do in House Bill 2088 is it would allow a city through an ordinance or resolution to adjust how that computation is done. So rather than being a countywide computation, you wouldn't use the countywide average, you would use just that average within the city itself. So depending upon where the city is, where the city average is of the real market value to assess value is in comparison to the overall county, you could either have properties coming on within that city at a higher assessed value than they would countywide or a lower assessed value countywide. And again, the countywide is the status quo for right now. And this, I suppose I can leave it there because I think there are some examples in testimony that will be coming up as well from some of the cities.
I think we will. And what does the bill do then?
So the bill makes that change. It allows the cities to then specify, rather than using a countywide average, they would use the average within their city boundaries.
Thank you.
Question?
Yes, please. Representative Marsh.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just to clarify, it doesn't allow the cities to change that basic formula to say, for example, if it's 75% for them to say, well, really, we're going to use 85%.
Right, Representative Marks. Yes, it's changing. The formula will stay the same. It's just the property to which the formula is based. And
right.
That's just because some cities will have different ratios of the property within it. One might be at 0.8, where the countywide is 0.7.
Right.
Yes.
Other questions for Kyle? I think let's call Eric Chambers, Elizabeth McCann, and Wendy Johnson, please.
The question.
I'm sorry.
Can you just key down a little bit?
Representative Buehler? Oh, he wants to see a little more.
Yeah, that good. That's good. Thanks.
Yeah.
Good
Welcome to Gresham. Thanks for coming to Salem today.
Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, thank you for inviting us to Salem today. My name is Eric Chambers. I'm the Government Relations Director for the City of Gresham. I'm very happy to be here to talk about House Bill 2088 and express the city's support for this bill. As Kyle mentioned, many of the problems in Oregon's property tax system and problems, in fact, that you have heard often during this session and previous sessions relate to provisions in the system that are in the Oregon Constitution. So they would require a vote of the people either by initiative or referral in order to get at those. And we all know that the transaction costs in that regard and the difficulty of doing so. Some of the problems and inequities in Oregon's property tax system exist in statute, and they are not the wide sweeping reforms that, of course, we would like to see in terms of the city of Gresham's druthers, but still an opportunity to make the system operate better, a bit more precisely, and with more fairness and equity amongst homeowners within the jurisdiction. As Kyle mentioned, when Measure 50 was drafted, or when Measure 50 was implemented, the legislature had to figure out how to implement the different measures. And one of the questions that would naturally come to mind is, how do you treat new property or improvements to property that are going to come on the tax rolls after the legislation was enacted? How would you establish an initial taxable assessed value or maximum assessed value for those properties? And I think that the remedy from a broad perspective makes some sense to take that countywide average and say, which I think in itself recognizes that there are different economies that exist within Oregon, county by county. What we've learned in the two decades since then is that even within counties, there are dramatically different economies. In Multnomah County, for example, we see rapid real market value growth in the urban core in inner Portland. And that combined with the city of Portland's larger size, substantially larger size than the other jurisdictions in the county, has created a condition where the countywide change property ratio is skewed heavily from other jurisdictions' individual change property ratios within that county. To put some context around that, right now the average taxable assessed value or maximum assessed value to real market value ratio in Gresham is around 80%. Every new property that comes on the tax rolls in Multnomah County right now is around 50%. So there's an immediate subsidy that's created for new development versus homeowners who have lived in their property, or not lived in their property, for properties that have existed on the tax rolls for a larger period of time. My home was built in 1960, so my taxable assessed value to real market value ratio is going to be much closer than a brand new property that has come on. Again, the real world consequences of that are that we have, you know, literally homes that are side by side. A ranch home that was built in 1980 sitting next to an infill home that's new development, where the infill home will come on at the county average, around 50%, the existing home will be paying at a taxable assessed value that's at 80% or higher. And so this is an opportunity to come in, again, with two decades of knowledge since the implementation of Measure 50, take a smaller brush to the problem and give cities the opportunity to elect a comparator themselves if they choose to do so. And we do have some examples to kind of walk through briefly what that looks like, and I'll ask my colleague Elizabeth McCann, our senior financial analyst at the city, to walk through those. If we can get her presentation up, that would be terrific. Thanks.
No, thank you. Chair Barnhart and members of the committee. My name is Elizabeth McCann, and I am the Senior Financial Analyst for the City of Gresham. I appreciate the opportunity to be here this afternoon to discuss House Bill 2088. I'd like to take a few minutes to go over a few of the points that Eric mentioned in greater detail. Within Multnomah County, there is a diverse real estate market. There are areas of the county that can see double-digit percentage increases in housing prices annually, while there are other areas that might only see increases in the 3-5% range, leading to a highly complex real estate situation within the county. Homes on the western side of the county have seen increases in value on the upper end of the scale, while homes in Gresham have seen much more modest gains in market value over the last several decades. The city of Portland, real market value of homes makes up about 87% of the residential market of the county, while Gresham is just shy of 8%, and all the other cities and unincorporated county equal about 5%. This means that the Portland residential real estate market drives the countywide trends, while the real estate market in the rest of the county has minor impacts. Over the last 20 years since Measure 50 was implemented, Multnomah County as a whole has seen significant market value, which has led to the change property ratio, the ratio of taxable assessed value to real market value, to steadily drop. If the countywide CPR is compared to the estimated CPR for the city, the county average is about 20 percentage points lower than the city due to the modest growth experienced in the city of Gresham. This difference results in large inequities between properties of different ages. To provide a real life example, we have a side-by-side comparison of two homes. For my example today, on the left, a house built in 1980, and on the right, a house built in 2016. Both have identical real market values as determined by the assessor. The 1980 house has a taxable assessed value of $297,000, while the 2016 house has a taxable assessed value of $190,000, more than $100,000 less. As you can see on the screen, the 1980s house ratio of taxable assessed value to real market value is approximately 81%, while the 2016 houses ratio is just under 52%. This means that the newer home pays about $1,800 less annually for public services than the older house, even though they have equal market value. Under House Bill 2088, the cities would be able to elect to use a localized change property ratio calculated for each property class within their city limits. If we go back to our same example, assuming that this bill had been in place when the 2016 house was first placed on the tax rolls, its assessed value would now be approximately $274,000, and it would pay a mere $158 less in property taxes than the house built in 1980, substantially increasing the fairness and equity between properties. While they're still not exactly equal due to the nature of using averages, the taxes for both houses will be much closer. By narrowing the scope of the area for which the change property ratio is calculated, the differences between houses within the same city will be substantially reduced, in this particular case by about 90%. In conclusion, while House Bill 2088 does not correct 100% of the horizontal inequities, it does address a substantial amount of the issue by allowing new properties within the city limits to be more closely compared to similar existing houses within the city instead of within the county, or as in the case of Multnomah County, Gresham being compared to Portland. Thank you for allowing me to testify today.
Thank you very much. Wendy.
Just for a moment, Mr. Chairman, if I might follow up on a couple of those points.
Please.
A couple important points on House Bill 2088. Just to clarify, this would not change the tax bill of any existing improved property, so we're not going retroactively and changing anything in that regard. And for context, this is not an overwhelming windfall from a revenue perspective for us in any way. I think we get around $25 million a year in property taxes. Had this measure been on the books last year, we would have had an additional $30,000. So it's not on scope. The additional revenue to pay an appropriate amount for public services is laudable and important, but the fairness is also very important to us. And then we did have an opportunity this morning to look at the testimony on OLIS regarding some of the concerns with the measure. And I wanted to just speak to a couple of those. Yes, this measure would increase some complexity in our property tax system. I think the opportunity to not have a complex property tax system probably lost us in the 1990s. And at this point, I think trading some fairness for some complexity is probably important, although I do understand that it would increase complexity. And then the two other concerns in terms of timing of notification to the assessor, we're wide open to any amendments to define what the mechanics of that would look like, and certainly work with the assessors in that regard. And then the concern that we could change often, was another, we would compare one way one year, one way another. I think the nature of the economics would probably not work that way, but we would also be open to friendly amendments to define a time period once every 5 years or something like that the cities could elect by resolution to change the calculation for that. With that, I'll hand it over to Wendy.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Chair Barnhart, members of the committee. Wendy Johnson here on behalf of the League of Oregon Cities. As I'm sure you know, one of the league's priorities, again, for this session is property tax reform. Many of those big property tax reform bills are in the Senate, but this is one of the few in the House. And it's different in that it's the only one that really can change the equity issue that's not in the Constitution. You can change this one by statute. And it's important to note that you look at the bill, it doesn't have the Legislative Council's note about it being a 3/5. This is purely a local option to allow cities to make this choice, so it's not a tax increase. And so the question really is, does this help with fairness or not? And it's a policy question for you all to look at. When the voters passed Measure 95, as was explained, the deal was you took your real market value and you subtracted 10%, and that became your assessed value. And then we did the 3% thereafter. And so for this situation, we're talking about properties that didn't exist in 1995 or improvements to property that makes one of the exceptions. And so we have to figure out some other way to give it a discount from real market value. So I think the obvious is real market value. We are so far from real market value now from 1995 because of the weird 3% and how this has worked with the real estate market. And so it's blatantly unfair to have examples of houses that have totally different taxes. This would be one way for a city to say this really isn't fair. We have parts of our city subsidizing the rest of the city, and it's just odd. For example, right now we're trying to build like crazy to catch up for years of non-building, and we need affordable housing, etc. And so you would think that this would be the time where cities and counties and school districts would be getting more on the property tax rolls. But during this time of growth, it's the opposite happens. The gap between assessed value and real market value grows. So they're coming on the tax rolls at 50% or 60% discount, which is the opposite of what you want to have happen, because you're having to provide infrastructure to the new development. And so it's a lose-lose for cities right now to have this bad ratio and want to build and need to build. So this bill does give that opportunity. It's definitely not the silver bullet. It only helps some of our cities if should they choose to do it. It would be a city ratio, which does cause another taxing district formula for the assessors, and we understand that. Obviously, we would prefer that you fix the whole property tax system, which does require a referral. We would like to go back to real market value instead of this complicated assessed value nightmare that we have. We know that we need to do that gradually. But I want to just give a couple other examples from the Department of Revenue's tax report. In the 2013-14 fiscal year, the statewide ratio decreased. I mean, it was 0.78, and now this year, for the 14-15, it was 0.75. So, as I said, the economy is growing, and our CPR is getting a bigger discount. So it's almost at a 25% average across the state. It's the opposite of what you want to have happen. Deschutes County gave me the example that can be a positive or negative, depending on how you look at it. Residential properties in the run-up to the recession were at 43%. And then when we hit the bottom of the recession, the CPR was 95%. So that actually kept that city afloat because of how that ratio worked. So it can have positive and negative effects, this crazy CPR. But we think this is as a tool to help restore equity. And it's one thing you can do in statute, because the voters said we want to continue to give a discount to all properties, but they didn't define the formula. This would allow you to change the formula from a county average to a city average. And with that, I'd be happy to take any questions.
Thank you very much. Questions for this panel? This is the only proponent panel for the measure. I have at least one, maybe more than that, after we get talking. Who does this affect? Who's likely to use this mechanism if it becomes available, other than Gresham? I assume Gresham will. That's why you're here. But who else is likely to use it? And what would the effects be there? And also, maybe I already know the answer to this one, but let me ask it anyway. What's the effect on, in York County, on Portland, if Gresham were to be carved out? Several questions at once. Take whichever ones you like first, and let's get to all of them eventually.
You bet. Thank you, Chair Barnhart. On the question of who's likely to use it with hesitating to speak on behalf of my colleagues in local government.
Who have you heard from? Where are the rumors?
Yes. Well, you'll notice testimony in Olas from the city of Tualatin that has a similar condition, although not as acute as the condition that we experience in Multnomah County. In any county where you have a jurisdiction that's had rapid growth and other jurisdictions that have not had as rapid of a growth, you would have some jurisdictions that are similarly disposed as Gresham in the situation. So you can think about the Eugenes and Salems, Bends of the world that have had rapid growth, and then other jurisdictions that haven't come along quite to the same degree or to a much lower degree across the state. So anytime that you would have a jurisdiction in that condition, they would be similarly disposed. Of course, in Multnomah County, again, because of Portland's dramatically larger size, combined with their dramatically larger market value dramatically more rapid market value increases than the other jurisdictions in Multnomah County have seen, then you just have a heavy, heavy skew on that. But you would have the same condition occurring in other places in the state as well.
Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, I would just add the county part is complicated because, let's say in Gresham's case, they do adopt this. Their assessed value numbers are going to go up, and then that's over the real market value. And so then all of those numbers would be swept under the county's numbers. So the gap between assessed value and real market value should also go up, I think, for the county, if I've got that right, Kyle. So that, in effect, would help, in my opinion, all the taxing districts have a less of a discount, a higher CPR.
Sorry, I apologize. That's correct. Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, I forgot the other half of your question. I apologize. We have done some research on the Multnomah County side, what that would look like. Again, because in most cases that you see this condition occurring, it's going to be a larger city that's driving the skew on the CPR. And so the net effect back on a single smaller jurisdiction changing or choosing to compare to themselves would have a minor impact, again, on that countywide change property ratio. So we try to calculate what that would look like in Multnomah County, and I think Elizabeth will correct me if I'm wrong, it was less than 1% in terms of the skew back to the countywide change property ratio were this to occur, but it would have a positive revenue impact, and as Wendy mentioned, it would help close the gap between maximum assessed values and real market values countywide.
Thank you. Isn't it fair to say that if, upon doing the calculation, a city believed that its ratio would be better, that it would adopt this method, and if it after evaluation thought it was not going to be better, it would not adopt the method. And the effect of that would be to increase some property taxes, and it wouldn't change anybody else's property taxes except in that margin that you were talking about where the effect of the local ratio affected the countywide ratio.
Chair Barnhart, that's members of the committee. That is correct. I think from a rational actor perspective, cities would do this calculation themselves and make that determination. I think notably they would have the option to not make that change should they choose. There are cities in Oregon that don't levy their full permanent rates, for example. There's, you know, the home rule opportunity for them to decide what works best for their communities. So you might not see it happen in every case, but I think in most cases, cities would do this calculation and they would make that determination.
So the next question then is, in how many cities, where are they, would these conditions apply? We don't know the cities that are actually going to make the move, but where would it be, would a rational actor make the move?
Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, unfortunately, we don't have access to enough statewide revenue data to know exactly where this would be. Kyle might have more information on
that. Kyle's nodding his head when I ask him, can we find out?
Excellent.
He said yes, so we'll go with that. Other questions? Has that stimulated other questions from the panel, from the members of the committee? Thank you very much. We appreciate your testimony. Doug Schmidt, Gil Riddell, please. Anyone else want to be heard on this bill today? Thank you. Gentlemen.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I am Gil Riddell, Policy Director, Association of Oregon Counties. I'm going to let Doug speak first because we will cover much of the same territory, and he is the expert. So,
even though you spoke first.
Well, I had to introduce you, Doug. You go ahead.
Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, Douglas Schmidt, Polk County Assessor. I'm testifying today on behalf of the Oregon State Association County Assessors, OSACA, and probably you're going to be surprised that we oppose this bill. It does bring another level of complexity into the whole complex property tax system. There's several things that assessors have concern about or unclear on, and my testimony was submitted, so hopefully it's in there. One of the things that was brought up by the prior presenter was there is no time period in the bill as to when the ordinance has to be passed. The change property ratio calculation is done at the very end of the year, right before we start calculating taxes. So we would need something early in the year in order to get everything set up. And again, for the new members on the committee, Kyle did a good job of explaining the change property ratio. It's applied only to new property within the county. That could be residential, commercial, farm, could be land that's been split. And that is, Polk County carries seven change property ratios in our county. They are residential, commercial, state industrial, rural, farm, timber, apartments, manufactured structures, and machinery and equipment. So what this would mean is anytime a city decided they wanted to create the area as the county, we would have to create those new change property ratios and do the calculation and apply them only to that city. The assessor's computer systems are not able to do that at this point, so it would take reprogramming for us to be able to do that calculation. It was interesting, some of the prior speakers mentioned the talk on the Senate side about redoing the assessment and taxation, or Measure 5 and Measure 50, and it was based on efficiencies, fairness, the inequity that's in the current system, and this bill continues those inequities within the city. The people prior to me used the example of an older home and a newer home, but there's still going to be inequity between the new homes that have been built. You could have a home right next to another one that was built 1 year, say in 2015, and then in 2017. Same house, same value, but the one is going to have 20 to 30% higher taxes because of the new change property ratio that's just by the city. There's no prohibition in the bill that would keep a city from declaring their area as the city, and then the next year changing back because it was more beneficial to them. That's a concern we have of jumping back and forth, and so that needs to have some clarification. When you have cities that cross county lines, which I have two of them in Polk County, and I'm a small county, Willamina and the city of Salem, cross county lines, we would have to do a more complex calculation for the change property ratio than just the countywide ratio that we have now. There is the only thing that's been talked about so far is the residential change property ratio. Like I said, there's at least eight other ratios that we calculate, and there's been no discussion of any analysis that has been done by the cities to see if there would be a detrimental effect. They could have a higher residential change property ratio, but what about their rural or their commercial or their industrial ratios? So those have not been discussed. It's only the inequity between the residential properties. Another thing that I'm still not clear on, the bill is not clear, and Chair Barnhart, you brought this up about carving out the city's assessed value or the city's market value and assessed values in the calculations for the remaining. Is it carved out? Can the county not use that city's values in their change property ratio? And what impact does that have on the county's change property ratio and then its impact on taxes or other cities? So that isn't spelled out in the bill as to whether or not those values are left in to the countywide calculation or if they have to be pulled out. So for all of these reasons, making a complex system even more complex, the fact that it does not necessarily address the inequities and unfairness Again, you have cities that border each other in large counties. You could have totally different change property ratios across the street. And at least now it's a countywide. So there's a lot of issues that some of them are just us having to explain to people the differences, and others are processes that we have to implement. So if you have any questions, I'd be happy to try and answer them.
Mr. Chair, may I?
Please.
I would just add on behalf of AOC that we're concerned about the expense. I don't have any idea at this point what this would cost counties to do this. It would depend, I'm sure, upon the answers to the questions that Doug posed. We would like, none of us like this property tax system. It's horrendously complicated and virtually impossible to explain. But we would like to have resources to be able to send more appraisers into the field to make sure that this property tax system, if it's going to be run, is capturing and is done fairly in the sense that we have all potential taxpayers paying the tax, so that there aren't people not, who are getting away with it because our field staff is so small in the counties. So that would be the additional issue that AOC would be concerned about.
Thank you. Representative Nose, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I like this bill, and I'm listening to your objections, and I'm wondering if we can address some, if not all, the concerns about timing it in the right way so that it doesn't create burden for you, or clarifying the time frame so that there's not a jumping back and forth and a gaming. I think that's a perfectly legitimate concern. The county line issue I'm struggling with a little bit, but I think we could expend some brain energy and try to figure that out. And maybe you just say a city that has that problem can't avail themselves of this, if you can convince me of that. With that, if we can come up with some amendments to meet those objections, does this make you a little more favorable toward the bill?
Chair Barnhart, Representative Nose. It resolves some of the issues, but it still doesn't take away the additional complexity of having multiple change property ratios within a county that we have to track, that we have to explain why their value is different than somebody else. Maybe if this was, anyway, that's okay. My, yeah.
Follow.
Yes, please, yeah.
So I am, I'm in complete agreement with you that we should scrap this overly complex, unfair system. I'm hopeful the Senate is figuring something out, but even if they do, and even if we vote on it here, we have to run a campaign because it's constitutional, and I don't want to take a valuable time waxing philosophical about whether or not that could pass. In the meantime, this feels like something we can do, albeit small, and if we address your concerns, that would introduce a slight modicum of fairness to a system that I agree is too complex.
Chair Barnhart, Representative Nose, if you can address the horizontal inequity to this caused by this bill compared to the horizontal inequity under the current system, and how you can explain to a taxpayer that their taxes are 30% higher than the exact same property next door because it was built a year later, then we might consider this.
We heard test. Oh, I'm sorry. Do you?
I mean,
go ahead.
I don't. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't know how to follow up with that, right? Because it's built into the system, right? So, I mean, that is a crappy outcome as well, I would argue. So, you know, I don't have a good answer for that, but I guess I'm trying to address, you know, the ones that I can, one bad consequence at a time.
Thank you. We heard testimony a minute ago that Gresham would have an increase in revenue of $30,000 if this had been in effect, I think, last year, maybe the year before. What would it cost for a county to make the software and other changes necessary in order to be able to calculate with these with this law, assuming that the issues involving timing and the like could be resolved?
Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, a month or two ago, I checked with our software provider. It's a small company here in Salem that 12 counties use that software. They said it could cost a minimum of $20,000 for reprogramming, and it could go up depending on if there's any other complex issues that would be addressed. I mean, it could be a single county issue. So just from the one software company, it's about at least $20,000. And there are primarily three software providers in the state, plus a couple of homegrown systems that they would have to then fund that out of their own pocket to do that. So just from the 12 counties using the system I have, it's at least $20,000 to reprogram.
Okay, so I assume that if the committee were serious about moving a bill like this, you would want the county to be reimbursed for those costs by the city that had made the change.
Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, I think that would be fair.
Thank you. Other questions for the panel? Representative Benz, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The gerrymandering that this bill attempts.
Not a loaded question.
Just killed it.
Could we, balkanization, whatever word you want to use, can we narrow it down to a point that it doesn't get any better because it's a matter of time, isn't it, as opposed to the space? So I'm hard pressed to see how this helps very much. But the chair is trying to get to a point of measuring the good or the bad of it, mm-hmm. by virtue of what it would cost to try to do this little bit of
cost good. Benefit.
Right. Mm-hmm. Is there some other way to redefine the lines? Or I don't see it, but I'm asking you. Can we, instead of the cities, let's do it by block. If not by block, then let's do it by neighborhood. If not by, you get my drift. I don't think it gets better, but that's what I'm asking.
Chair Barnhart, Representative Benz, and again, I understand this complex. I understand the cities wanting to do this, but they even admitted that even within cities, there's different areas that go up faster or slower. So you could do it by neighborhood, but it's a lot of counties don't have properties broken out by neighborhood. So I'm not sure. I'm not sure that there's a way to categorize it down low enough that it would really benefit. And then it would just create even more complexity because you have a smaller area trying to do the exact same thing. I apologize if I wasn't able to answer your question.
My follow-up is that's the conclusion I had reached, that it didn't get any better by virtue of what I just said. That was what I was asking, though,
to ask
an expert.
Well, the conversation at Howard did flush out the department, and they're now ready to talk. Please.
Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, Mark Garst with the Oregon Department of Revenue Property Tax Division. So I just wanted to say that when I first read this bill, and it was really the gerrymandering word that kind of made me jump up. When I first read this bill, the way I read it is that you would pull out the areas that were not in the city and recalculate the CPR for the rest of the county, excluding that area. And so that would tend to put, it seems like that would put the larger city at a lower CPR a little bit, but then new property coming in would be closer to their average, and new property coming in Gresham would be closer to the Gresham average. So I don't think it does anything for uniformity countywide, but just that change in itself would, I think, tend to mitigate what Wendy described, which is something that just really jumped out at us, is that this will have the effect of pushing up the countywide CPR over time. So if each of the cities that would have a higher CPR self-select, follow this program, then over time, they're going to get calculated again into the countywide CPR. And maybe this isn't lost on anybody. Maybe this is really the policy that you folks want. But it would have the effect of pushing up the countywide CPR over time. And that was kind of something that really just jumped out at us. If you want to mitigate it, you could just say that the rest of Multnomah County calculates their CPR without Gresham, and then you wouldn't have that effect.
Thank you. Any other questions this generates? Thank you all. Thank you very much for the testimony. And with that, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2088 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2022. Mazin.
Okay. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2022 deals with the issue of volumetric mixers. And at this point, I think we would be looking at that in just a few minutes. We have presentation about it from the Association of CAPA to introduce you to volumetric mixers. But let me tell you the background of this bill is that we, at one point, it was in the Transportation Policy Committee, and as we were trying to write a revenue impact statement for the bill, we were trying to put our hands around this revenue impact and if there is. And it seems like those volumetric mixers were treated differently into different counties. And we were not at that time able to figure out what these differences are on how we can deal with them to write a consistent revenue impact statement. So we thought by bringing this issue and discussing the type of one, revenue, and two, how we deal with that would be the right thing for the revenue committee. So that's the background of it, and Representative Evans is here to address the bill. And also after that, we have, as I mentioned, the panel from the industry to explain what the volumetric mixers are.
Ah, okay. So we do have some people signed up for this bill. I don't see a sign. I don't see a sign up. So I didn't realize we had people signed up. All right, Representative Evans, please.
Yes, sir. Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, I'll try to keep my testimony very brief. I submitted a letter. Hopefully you've had a chance to get it. It's relatively brief for me, which I know is a surprise, shocking. I actually can write briefly sometimes. This bill really does two things, and the first is it provides fairness, and the second is it actually attempts to simplify something. The folks that will come up later will actually show you, literally, picture side by side why these trucks are actually trucks and why the ongoing existing situation where some trucks are being treated differently than other trucks isn't terribly fair, and it actually, in a weird way, works against our long-term interests in environmental policy. Because the trucks that we're trying to include in this and get treated as real trucks actually are better for the environment because they don't require you to waste all kinds of concrete and dump it at the end of the day, releasing emissions. The kind that's going to be presented today and explained is actually a more efficient, more effective, and more environmentally friendly piece of equipment. So it's one of those things where it's good policy, it's actually a good thing for small business, and it's actually good for the earth. So I'm going to invite folks up here. Hopefully they can come up and do their little slideshow. The bottom line is this is one of the few measures that we can really actually point to the small businesses we can be helping by providing simplification. And the best part is the only county that's currently charging or trying to charge this particular tax is neutral on the bill because they recognize it's also pretty complex. So we won't be hurting anybody. We hope to avoid actually having to come to revenue because it does have such a small impact on the state as a whole. But we're really grateful for the opportunity to showcase how this is something we can actually do and help small businesses. Any questions before I?
Thank you, Representative. Why don't we hear from the panel?
Okay.
I'm particularly interested. The entire bill is a bill that amends the rule that defines fixed load vehicle. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that would be useful for us to know, and perhaps this is a question for staff, is why do we care? What is the effect of changing the definition of fixed load vehicle on Oregon's taxes? Because that, after all, is what this committee is about.
Yes, sir.
And I assume they're going to tell us that along with some other things.
Yes, sir.
Please, go ahead.
Thank you, Chair Barnhart, ladies and gentlemen of the committee. My name's Rich Angstrom. I'm the president of the Oregon Concrete Aggregate Producers Association. Represent most of the construction materials industries in the building, the asphalt folks, the concrete folks, a few of the cement folks, and obviously the aggregate folks. We picked up a new membership in a kind of a new configuration, vehicle configuration, came about 20-some years or so ago, and it's this volumetric vehicle where they basically keep all the sand, gravel, and cement separate, and they don't mix it at the batch plant. It's kept separate, and then you go out to the site, and you mix just what you need. So I put together a quick presentation on this, and I'll run through it pretty quick. This is the vehicle we're looking at. It's a volumetric mixer. It doesn't look like a transit mixer, what you think is a ready-mix truck, but it operates basically the same. In all of those bins, if you look at it very closely, you'll see that there's bins, mm-hmm. and it keeps the sand, gravel, and cement separate. And what we're trying to do here is basically have the two trucks treated the same. They compete with each other. The transit mixers are mostly owned by big companies like Knife River and Old Castle Materials, and the volumetric mixers, which are presently paying both weight mile taxes as well as personal property tax, we're trying to get it so that they're on that same competitive playing field, because it's a very small margin business, and this is trying to line them up so these guys can compete more effectively with the large guys. The other thing that it does, as we looked at the statute and we talked about it, for some reason, historically, the legislature confuses cement and concrete. And so everything in that statute says cement. And there isn't even such a thing as configurations that they have listed in there. So as a tutorial real quick, cement is an ingredient of concrete. A concrete is 6% air, 11% Portland cement, 41% sand and gravel, 26% sand, and 16% water. You mix all of those up, and you end up with concrete. What the statute we're doing is cleaning up some stuff that's just, there's no vehicle configurations. And we thought that was fair. Everybody wins. It's clear what's taxed on one side of the ledger, and then it treats these guys fairly on the other side. So I think I kind of went through that. We eliminate bullet point three there is we eliminate cement mixer, cement batch plant, cement paving finishers, because those vehicle configurations don't exist, but we replace them with concrete vehicles that actually do exist. That's a transit mixer, so people got a good idea what it is. And right there in the back is a chute, and what comes out is concrete. If you look at a volumetric mixer, and I think, is that you?
Yes, me.
Okay, so he's running the levers. What comes out of the back end of that is concrete. Mm-hmm. We think this kind of got started because there's a couple of companies use the word mobile mix, and the statute actually talks about mixed mobiles as being a fixed load vehicle. And so it would be subject to the tax. And we think the Department of Revenue had a fair argument. We thought we did on the legal side, but we kind of agreed on the policy, which is to try to treat people fairly. And so we decided not to have the legal argument, but have a policy argument of what's the fair way of doing this, because I think the statute kind of supports both arguments from at least our perspective. These are the kinds of things that are taxed as fixed load vehicles and have property taxes associated with them. And you can see that particular vehicle configuration is brought out, it's set up, it's permanent. You bring out the sand and gravel, and you make your product. And whether it's concrete or some other concrete product, that's the kind of thing that we think isn't subject to weight mile tax. They may have an oversized load payment at Motor Carrier, but it's not paid like their vehicles or a transit mixer, which is paying basically their PUC fees, weight mile tax, and all the registration fees. Keep going here. That's another one. This is a concrete batch plant. It's fixed. It pays property tax. And there, the point that we're trying to make is both of them deliver concrete. Both of them pay PUC. One of them doesn't pay property taxes. And this is the kind of thing these guys do, is PDX's airport upper deck repair by volumetric mixer, moves a small amount of material. It's working in a niche market in the industry. It's able to go out and do a bridge deck, and you can see that example there. Here's another one, bus pad on 82nd Avenue overpass. You can come in and mix the exact load that you need to fill in the gap there that you see that they've framed in. And here's another one, pouring the Canicum Bridge. Here's another example where a transit mixer generally is range, and Representative Johnson will know this, is pretty close, 30 miles or so. The nice thing about these things, because by keeping the product separate, you can extend your range to anywhere. I mean, you can drive across the state if you wanted. You don't run into the problem as you do in a transit mixer. You get too far away from the batch plant, the concrete tends to set up, and then you have a problem. And so there's one more example of an I-5 overpass using a volumetric mixer. This is in Bend. They're doing a roundabout with this actually is a different configuration. This is actually a transit mixer. It just looks different with a front end load. So we clean up the statute. We treat concrete trucks the same, and we ensure competitiveness. And that kind of sums up my testimony. We'd encourage this committee to support this bill. It's a pretty simple bill. We have, the only thing I would say is it's been applied one time in one county, Washington County, and that brought it to everybody's attention that we basically have a kind of a unfair situation for the smallest family-owned businesses in our industry, and we're trying to even things up so they can be competitive with the bigger boys. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Yes, sir.
He pretty much summed it up.
He did. Would you state your name for the record?
Rick Nation.
Rick Nation. And Mr. Nation, tell us a little bit about your business.
I own Nation's Mini Mix in Eugene, Oregon. Started the company in 1994. We're running 5 trucks at this time. And I also kind of represent volumetric mixer companies as far as selling the vehicles, the training, stuff like we're doing right here, kind of a representative. So I appreciate you guys looking at this bill. My concern about this, like Rich had mentioned, is being competitive with the ready mix guys. They're kind of at a disadvantage as to margins and stuff. We don't get quite the margins they get because of our buying powers and so forth. So I think it's kind of a double tax deal. Like you said, we're paying weight mile at this time. And I think it'd be detrimental to a lot of these smaller companies financially to have to do this. So, and then again, I think the way these things operate, I think we're offering a little bit more as far as environment goes. We don't waste any material. Whatever we mix to a 5-gallon bucket. We don't have to mix a 10-yard load. You take it out, dump 7, you got 3 extra, you're dumping it over the hill somewhere. Mm-hmm. So we feel like we're doing very good at this. So.
Thank you. Questions for this panel? Yes, Representative Johnson,
Thanks,
please.
Mr. Chair. I appreciate this. This is I haven't used these before, so we don't have them in our neck of the woods, but it's fascinating. So can you actually bring out a 10-yard batch just like a regular truck could? Or what's your capacity in one of these?
They vary in size, but for the most part, they're either 8 to 10-yard units. Most guys run that size.
Okay.
So, but we can mix. And then we can mix from, like I say, a shovel full
so you
to mix the whole batch, 10 yards.
Mix whatever PSI the operator wants, right?
Change the PSI, change the slump. And like Rich was saying, too, a lot of specialty stuff. We do a lot of highway work with a rapid setting material, like replacing panels on I-5, because we can get it back open to traffic within an hour.
Wow.
So there's not a 28-day strength gain to be able to open traffic up, so we're, you know.
You can run an 80,000-pound truck over it in an hour.
Yep.
Wow. Go ahead.
Well, I would say, Rich, you mentioned the one advantage here, the one in the radius and so forth. I would say with our traffic woes in the metro area, I would think you'd see more of these kind of effort. You know how long it's going to take you to get from Hillsboro to Gresham or vice versa.
Exactly.
You know?
Yeah. Exactly.
So you don't have that barrel spinning the whole time with that. You know, that batch starting to set.
Keeps the integrity of the material,
exactly.
For sure.
Exactly. Yeah, that's cool.
Chair Barnhart and Representative Johnson, one of the things we're finding, especially in the Portland market, moving ready mix, is the traffic is so significant that we're having to do it at night.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And one of the nice things about this is these guys don't have to go back to the plant to get another load. If they do a small job here and they have another small job, they can go directly to that, which cuts down on fuel use. and the carbon-related issues of just the the amount of mileage that we're putting on. It's really an efficient way of doing things, and it's not as good for just high volume because you can keep the margins down, but for this kind of thing, this is a really a good vehicle configuration. Mm-hmm. We need to support these guys.
Mm-hmm. Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, I'd like to conclude by just two things. Number one, saying thank you again to Washington County, because you would think that the county that has tried to assess the tax would say, hey, this is a revenue stream we see moving forward. It was a meaningful conversation. They recognized that really a truck is a truck is a truck is a truck, and I really appreciate their open-mindedness on this. The second thing is that the reason we're asking for the bill now is before other counties see some level of flexibility in the language, we want to clarify it so we don't actually disincentivize trucks that are probably over the long haul a better investment for the state. So that's why we're trying to nip it in the bud, and we ask for your consideration and just appreciate the opportunity to have a hearing today. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Other questions? I have a sort of structural questions that I never thought I would have, but I do. And this, with the four of you here, maybe we can get answers to these questions. I always assumed that trucks that paid the white mile tax also paid a personal property tax if they were as an item of a business equipment. But perhaps I was wrong about that.
Yeah. Chair Barnhart, I know Mazin's leaning in on this too, but the general rule is in the way the statute kind of functions is if you're kind of paying weight mile tax, you're basically moving material and product and commerce and materials and stuff, and you're not really setting up. So really this statute is set up, if you're setting up something more permanently or semi-permanently to do things, the fixed load stuff attaches, unless you're like a backhoe. That's one configuration. But another configuration that doesn't apply to this industry is like backhoes and scrapers and things like that are actually assessed as a property tax also. But if you're moving, engaging in the type of commerce we do, you're moving asphalt, concrete, aggregates, or for that matter, anything that is going in and out of Fred Meyer's, is those trucks are not paying those taxes, at least in our industry. I should speak for our industry. At least we're not. Mm-hmm.
So most vehicles moving in commerce don't pay property tax. They do pay the weight mile tax. And you're asking for what?
Well, what this specifically does is for this vehicle configuration, they will continue to pay their weight mile taxes and registration fees, and they'll be paying property taxes on all their loading equipment, back at the loading facility, which is things like loaders, and they have silos and things like that. Those all fall under the property tax side. But once that truck's loaded up and it's heading down the road, mm-hmm. they aren't taxed just for property tax, and this will clarify that.
Well, Mazin, you may not be ready today to do this, but it would be useful at some point to get an overview of the weight mile tax versus the personal property tax and how the legislature came up with a system where we charge a tax for the maintenance of the roads from heavy vehicles, but we don't charge a personal property tax on those vehicles at the same time, because it would seem logically that you would charge both. One is it's an asset in business, that's the personal property tax. The other is it's a vehicle traveling on the roads and causing wear and tear on the roads, and therefore you pay the weight mile tax. Now what I'm learning today is that you pay either one or the other, except for this little group that pays both. That's what I think I'm hearing. I think it would be useful for the committee, or at least maybe just for me, to get an idea of how the legislature came up with that idea that you only pay one or the other, and why.
Mr. Chair, the legislature came up with a lot of great ideas.
Well, we know that.
Mr. Understatement. Yes. One of them, I think a long time ago, is also to exempt vehicles, just vehicles from property tax, so they're not part of your property that you're taxed on.
That may be the answer to the question. So maybe you could tell us a little bit about why that was done.
And that was done way ago in probably the early part of the 20th century in order to go from the point of taxation and moving the road investment as to be the part of those affected by the moving vehicles type of things. So the whole thing was taken away and sliced from the what you call the general expenditure of the tax for the general purpose of and benefit of the society to have it more specific towards the user tax type of thing.
Okay.
But however, there are things that you do.
That was before the highway fund, I assume.
That was a long time ago.
Okay. So at the time that the highway fund was adopted, that tax suddenly became focused specifically on construction and maintenance of roads.
Right. And they,
before that,
and they instituted registration revenue instead of property tax, or in lieu of.
So. Okay. All right.
So I mean, there are several things. There are pieces of equipment that are still valued as business assets and depreciated as such.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a little different configuration on this. Mm-hmm. And later on, I also asked the Department of Revenue and the assessors to kind of also give you their impression on how this idea kind of developed and how the difficulties. So
okay, all right, that's helpful. Does this generate any other questions? The reason I ask these questions is because the bill is a surprise to me, because this is an area of tax that I don't recall us ever actually getting into before, at least in this committee.
Yeah.
I suspect Transportation Committee knows all about it, but this is not one that this committee's gotten involved in before. So the new members are no further at sea than the longer-serving members have been. Any other? Yes, Representative Marsh.
I just have a comment. I wanted to thank you for your kind explanation of the difference between cement and concrete. My son, who is a contractor, has frequently corrected me on this. And I'm glad to know I am in such good company in being confused about it, but never again.
Chair Bernhardt, Representative Marsh, thank you for that. The legislature, for some reason, has a real difficult time with the difference between concrete and cement.
Yeah. I think, Representative Marsh, what you're saying is that not only were you confused about it, but so was legislative council
yes.
when they wrote this law in the first place.
Yep.
Representative Smith-Warner, please.
Thank you. And in that same category, you mentioned on the list of items that make up concrete, mm-hmm. you said that one of the items is Portland cement.
Correct.
So is that
a brand?
Is that a brand? Is that a you know, species
of
concrete?
You have a good answer on that. Excuse me, Chairman Barnhart, committee. Portland cement is the standard for concrete, normal concrete. There is different types of Portland cement, like a 1-2 or a 3-5. And that kind of depends on where it's manufactured. It all comes out of the ground with a product called clinker. They grind the product and then cook it. And so there's different areas of the state or states that have different types of cement. And so they call that Portland cement. And why we got that name as Portland cement, I don't know, but there is, like on the Rapid Set cement, that is called Rapid Set cement, and it's manufactured actually in Mexico. So it's a different product, different area of the country, but it's all called Portland cement as far as all the specs and all that stuff goes.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Anything else for this panel? Anyone else want to be heard on this bill today? Yes, the department. You're working overtime today. Sorry? Oh, the assessors as well? Hey, don't be bashful. When it's your turn, come right up.
I didn't sign up.
So, Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, Mark Garst with the Department of Revenue Property Tax Division. I just wanted to say this is probably my fault that this got brought to the Revenue Committee. I saw it in the Transportation Committee, noticed that there was a revenue impact, and so I just thought I would bring it to your attention. Just to kind of emphasize what Mazin said, I think he pretty much hit on it. Typically, vehicles that are registered are not required to pay ad valorem property taxes. However, that section of the statute, 803585, says fixed load vehicles are not exempt from ad valorem taxation by this section. So fixed load vehicles do pay. And the Department of Revenue puts out a fixed load vehicle manual. And in that manual, as an example, one of the vehicles that are taxable is volumetric mixers. It's called a mixmobile in that manual. Washington County saw that, picked them up, and then that led to a court case that I think has now been, I don't think it's still active. So that's kind of what got us here a little bit. And, you know, if you look at the definition of fixed load vehicle, it specifically excludes certain things, including travel trailers, tow trucks, and truck-mounted transit mixers. And that is the transit mixer that has the cylinder on the back that spins, and while it's in transit, it's mixing. These, on the other hand, get to the site and then mix. And so the Washington County assessor, we think rightly, didn't think that this was a transit mixer, so therefore they felt that it was subject to property tax. And I don't know that that's the fair thing by any means, and this does to me, I mean, the department's neutral on the policy, but it does kind of seem like a little guy versus big guy kind of industry thing that's going on there. And, you know, these folks are currently should be taxed, and we've asked it, you know, our personal property tech groups, whether they are being taxed, and multiple counties raised their hands and said that they were taxing them. But we've heard that maybe only Washington County actually is. I don't know the answer to that question today. But per the statutes now, we think that they should be. But we don't really have any problem with you carving them out similar to what you've done for transit mixers. So with that, I take any questions.
Okay. Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, the assessors have discussed this, and our position is the policy, if we tax them or make them exempt, is fine. We just need a clear line. There was some confusion in the manual just kind of how counties viewed them. But it's more of if these are what you want to be exempt, assessors don't have any issues.
Okay.
Believe it or not.
Thank you. Well, of course, your point usually is to get as bright a line as you
yes.
can so that it reduces litigation and makes your job easier and therefore less costly for you as well.
Chair Barnhart, you are correct. And by doing this, by identifying these as an exempt from property tax vehicle, that gives us the line we need.
Mm-hmm. Great. Thank you. Questions? Thank you very much. I appreciate it. I've reread this section again, and I realize Section 1 says it is if, Section 2 says it isn't if, and or Subsection 2, and Subsection 3 talks about the things that are again. So if there is a Subsection 3, maybe it's only
Subsection 3 of C.
3 of C, right. Okay. Okay, so that was where my confusion lay in trying to understand what the bill was for in the first place. Anything else? Thank you. With that, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2022. Paul, any announcements? See you all tomorrow. Thank you very much. Committee is adjourned.